Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 124. This is the Newton Mass Edition, the last one before the reindeer shit hits the roof, so we're going to enjoy it. The two movies I'm going to talk about this time are 1962's Lawrence of Arabia, starring Peter O'Toole, Alec Guinness, and Anthony Quinn and Omar Sharif, one of the great classic blockbusters of all time. And the other is from much, much earlier, 1946, and in this case it is The Big Sleep, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. I just saw it the other day and I thought that one would suit really well for the podcast. So sit back, grab yourself a martini and a foie gras sandwich, and we'll get on with the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a podcast of movies more than 20 years old. It appears every 2 weeks, and it can be any genre of film except science fiction and fantasy, which is what my other podcast, The Martian Drive-In Podcast, is for. Feedback's very important to the podcast, so you can leave it by leaving a voicemail or else an email at cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and leave a message there. You can also leave a message on the voicemail line if you're in the USA or have access to that. The number has changed recently and it is 206-33-77721. The podcast occasionally contains adult concepts, so just be aware of that and don't play it when the kids are around in case I drop an F-bomb. But one way or the other, sit back and enjoy me and possibly a guest or two talking about classic cinema. Hi, how is everybody? I'm going to do my usual thing that I do this time of year, which is piss off the freezing masses in the Northern Hemisphere by saying it's a lovely sunny day outside, the flowers are blooming outside the man cave window, and everything is fine. It's been a little cooler for the start of summer than usual, but it's starting to get there, and it's starting to get where I want it to be as far as groovy weather is concerned. So things here, well, there are some changes going through I'm not going to bore you with, but we're both knuckling down and getting through them, and we will be spending the Newton Mass season at Sal's parents' place, not taking any time off apart from the public holidays, but there are going to be some cool things coming along. Sal went mad and basically bought up my Amazon wish list for my gift, and I'm going to have a box set of classic Hitchcock. I'm getting the Criterion edition of The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, Criterion edition of Medium Cool. The movie I talked about last podcast, Uptight, the Jules Dassin movie, I'm getting the Blu-ray of that as well, and a mass of other things, including a legitimate copy of Byron Haskins' The Power, which is a movie I kind of like. And just a bunch of other stuff as well. And she has scored pretty well over the season too. We give our gifts a little bit early when they arrive. You get them at our place. So it's not a bad thing. It's just the way we've kind of evolved, because I had a habit before we did that of guessing what my gift would be with unerring accuracy. And so we kind of gave up on that because of my miraculous and superhuman Sherlock Holmesian ability to guess Christmas presents. We evolved a different way of doing it around here. So I hope everybody is doing well there. I hope everybody is staying warm if you're in a place that basically turns into a refrigerator this time of year. So anyway, what have I been watching? The other thing I've got to mention too. I did my last session with ABC Darwin with my mate Ivor Cole talking about movie music. Ivor is not returning to the ABC next year. And so we had one last bromance moment, hanging out and talking about movie music. We did a number of classic films, including some music from La Dolce Vita, Jerry Goldsmith's theme from Chinatown and a few other bits and pieces, and just basically thanked each other. The friendship continues. But the other lovely thing that they've arranged up there is that next year I'm going to be continuing to talk about movies on ABC Darwin with the new evening's presenter, a lady called Liz Travaskis, of whom I hear good things. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun there. Because we tailor the music to the presenter, I'm going to be doing different kinds, movies that I talk about to the presenter. I'm going to be doing things a little differently next year. I'll find out what kind of movies Liz likes and doesn't like and kind of skew it a little bit to that so the discussions become what they should be. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. It's nice of them. They didn't have to do that, but they did. They obviously like what I'm doing. And I do look forward to doing that. It's just going to be a groovy thing, heading into the little TARDIS booth down in South Melbourne and just having a chat about film. And it goes all over the Northern Territory, so that's going to be a lot of fun. But I am going to miss Ivor. He's a fantastic friend. He is a polymath when it comes to music knowledge, and his generosity is just unending as far as supporting me in what I was bringing to his show. So I'll miss him, but we are going to get up there hopefully sometime next year and hang out a little bit anyway. So what have I been watching as far as movies are concerned, apart from the ones I'm going to talk about? Oh, by the way, I should mention while I'm bringing up my Mizzo at the moment, the next Martian Drive-In podcast will star myself and Rob Jan from 3RRR Community Radio 0G talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We do about an hour and a half or so of just shooting off each other, going through the history of the Marvel franchises on TVs and movies, and just kind of geeking out a little bit. So if you go over to the Martian Drive-In podcast a week after this one is released, you'll be able to hear Rob and I shooting the shit about cinema. Let's see what I have been watching. I did see Wings, the first movie to win an Oscar. Silent film, starring Chester Morris, Gary Cooper's in it as well, and a few other people. Yeah, it's an interesting old film. Clara Bow's in it as well, and there's a tiny snippet of nudity as well. It's a pre-code film. I kind of liked it. It's about World War One pilots training and going to war in World War One, and a nurse that one of them is in love with and all that kind of stuff. The really interesting thing I found, though, apart from the fact that I could see them trying to stretch the special effects and other things in there, it was really a worthy effort for the time and cost, I think, $2 million, which is an enormous amount in 1928. Gary Cooper's in it for 2 minutes. He plays another pilot who's a bit more experienced than the two guys in training. He talks to them about how dangerous it is and how to be careful and all that. Then he goes out and has a crash. That 2 minutes, right at the start, almost at the start of Wings, gave Gary Cooper his career. On the screen, he was charismatic. He was a very fine-looking man, and he projected well to the camera. And 2 minutes of film ended up with a career that didn't end until the 1960s. So that's pretty good going, and it's interesting to see how just how some people are naturals in front of the camera and how when they're on the screen you can't take your eyes off them. And Gary Cooper was very much like that. Even in this film, he kind of blew the other guys away in 2 minutes out of a two-hour film. So I recommend that. It's actually out on Blu-ray in Australia. I picked it up for a ridiculously small amount of money. But being a film buff, of course, you've got to have a copy of these classic films when they come up. And I hadn't seen it before, but I did very much enjoy it. Let's see. Here's the other story. There's a story at the other end of things. Back in, and this is a little bit of a sad tale, but I'm going to tell it anyway to explain why things rolled out the way they did in this one. Back when it first came out, I went to see Dario Argento's Suspiria in the cinema. That was back in the days when I was heading out to the movies, seeing as many things as I could, as quick as I could. Rubbish, good stuff, anything at all. So I go to see Suspiria, and I was having trouble at home. I was a teenager. I was having trouble at home at the time. And I was in, let's just say, a very distressed state. I was basically having a bit of a breakdown. Seeing a movie like Suspiria with the strident music, the primary colours, just the nerve-janglingness of it, I left the cinema about three quarters of the way through in a highly distressed state. not the kind of headspace you should be when you see a movie like Suspiria. So about a month ago, I picked up the Blu-ray of it and tried to watch it again 5 days ago. Still don't like it. Still didn't get all the way through it. I really found the music unpleasant. I found the primary use of primary colours and the setups obvious. I don't think it's a particularly good film. It's one of the very few movies that I actually stop and don't watch the end of. I'm going to give it one more go, maybe in a year's time, and I'll let you know what happens with that. But I don't think that particular movie, and I have seen a number of giallo and enjoyed them, but that particular movie, maybe it's a post-traumatic stress disorder thing about the film. Maybe it's just the film itself, but I really didn't manage to get through it. So that was another cinematic experiment that failed, a little bit like most of the things Steven Spielberg does. Let me see what else I have watched. I rewatched something that's kind of interesting. When 8 Bells Toll, it's an action film about a bunch of people stealing bullion by sinking ships in the 1970s. Let me just see when it came out. I'm just going to bring it up on the screen. 1971. It's the only movie I know of where Anthony Hopkins plays a James Bond type character, young Tony Hopkins. And it's got a good supporting cast as well. Robert Morley's in it, Natalie Delon, Jack Hawkins, who's also in Lawrence of Arabia, of which I will speak later, and Corin Redgrave. It's based on an Alistair MacLean novel, and it's not a bad little 1970s actioner, British-made actioner, but Anthony Hopkins as a James Bondy character, given the fact that we know most of Mr. Hopkins' work from his latest stuff as Hannibal Lecter and other roles like that. It's quite interesting to see him play a young, dashing guy. I don't think he's in the top best shape in the world. They had to get him into shape a little bit, get him to drop a bit of weight to play the role. I don't think he's physically suited particularly to be playing the kind of character he's supposed to be playing. But he puts it across pretty well, and it's interesting from an historical viewpoint and also to see his progress as an actor. So that was a little bit of fun as well. I did also watch an incredibly bad film, which was on TV, and I thought, what the hell, give it a bit of a go. It's only going to spend an hour and a half, but I kind of regret spending the hour and a half or so watching it. Was Son of the Mask, starring Jamie Kennedy. I'm not even going to talk about that very much, except to say piss poor and really ugly, scary CGI child in it. You've really got to see that one as a definite failed opportunity to do something funny, and they simply didn't. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about The Big Sleep. And I'll leave Lawrence of Arabia a second, because it's the bigger film in so many ways.
You,
sir? Oh, yeah, I'm looking for a good mystery on something off the beaten track like the Maltese Falcon.
Oh, that was a fascinating story. But here's one that has everything the Falcon had and more. It's Raymond Chandler's latest bestseller, The Big Sleep. What a picture that'll make.
Mind if I look at it? Sometimes I wonder what strange fate brought me out of the storm to that house that stood alone in the shadows. As I probed into its mysteries, every clue told me a different story. But each had the same ending, murder. Every instinct warned me to beware that something more dangerous, more deadly than I'd ever known before was in that room. And suddenly,
I like that. I'd like more.
Okay, The Big Sleep is one of the classic kind of detective movies in a way. The filming started in 1944, and there were a few refilms done in 1946 as well. And there were several different cuts. There's a 1944 cut, there's a 1945 cut, there's a 1946 cut of this film. The studio had a lot of problem with it because it was a bit racy for the time. And so various different bits and pieces were cut out, added, enhanced, refilmed, and things like that. It's just a bit of a dog's breakfast at times, but yet it's still one of the classic films noir. In the movie, Humphrey Bogart plays Philip Marlowe, a private eye based on the character in Raymond Chandler's novels, which I recommend highly. If you haven't read Chandler's work, it's beautifully written. It's got some lovely similes and metaphors in it, and it just rolls along nicely. Chandler himself was a bit of a problematic person. He was an alcoholic. He was very bitter about certain things. He wasn't necessarily a nice person, but he did put together a world around Philip Marlowe, which is very, very interesting. Corruption and darkness, pornography and deviance. Homosexuality, of course, was an exotic deviance at the time rather than almost mainstream as it is now. The other people in the cast, of course, Laura Bacall, who Bogart had met while they were making To Have and Have Not a couple of years before. She and Bogart were having an affair at the time. Of course, they married, and they were married until his death in January 1957. So she's in there playing Vivian Sternwood Rutledge, John Ridgely playing Eddie Mars. Martha Vickers, very interesting, playing the other Sternwood sister, Carmen. She's really good at it. Regis Toomey, playing Chief Inspector Bernie Oles, who's a policeman friend of Philip Marlowe's. Charles Waldron played General Sternwood. He interviews Marlowe and tells him what he wants to do at the start of the film. Charles Waldron died before the movie was released, so that was a bit of a problem for him. A couple of other people who are very interesting. Dorothy Malone as the girl in the bookshop is quite fun. And there's also a cab driver, Joy Barlow, who's interesting in this film as well. And I'll kind of talk about that just a little bit more. The plot line is difficult. And they've got to mention the script as well. The script was written by William Faulkner, of course, Jules Firthman, and Lee Brackett. Lee Brackett, one of the great and not as well known as she should be, screenwriters of the 1940s to 1970s in Hollywood. She also wrote a bunch of short fiction, science fiction and fantasy stuff, and her writing is excellent. Things like Shamblow are classics of the genre, really. She also wrote the script for Rio Bravo, The Long Goodbye, another Philip Marlowe movie starring Elliot Gould, very different interpretation of the character. And in 1980, she helped write the screenplay for The Empire Strikes Back. So she went all the way from Humphrey Bogart to Luke Skywalker. You gotta admit that the lady had range. The movie was directed by Howard Hawks, and much has been written about the Hawksian women, the women in Howard Hawks novels. They stand up to their men, they look them eye to eye, they're not ashamed of being sexual beings. They admire the men for what they do, but they've got their own inner life, and they're very vivid. They're not necessarily from a 21st century viewpoint entirely feminist, but they do have a forthrightness which kind of inspired a number of women subsequently. I've actually had a conversation with a couple of women who said that among their favourite characters are some of the women in Howard Hawks novels, because they taught them things like women can be journalists, women can have their own lives, women don't have to follow traditional roles, and Hawks women very rarely did. So all strength, and Hawks also liked those kind of women. He married several of them, women who were forthright. They could stand toe-to-toe and knock back the whiskey, same as their men. Not necessarily like a kind of masculine kind of woman, a woman who knows herself and has confidence. I think the Hawksian women, the overwhelming quality that they have is their self-confidence and their self-knowledge. And it's a very attractive thing, and particularly in this movie, it works out very, very well. Now, the plot of this movie is, as I said, problematic, because the screenwriters actually called up Raymond Chandler and said, who killed one of the characters? Because there are a number of murders in there and a mystery. But they said, who killed one of the characters? And Chandler said to them, it's in the book, read it. And so they read the book very carefully, as you do, and then came back and said, who killed him? It's not in the book. So Chandler went away and looked at the book again. Anyway, you're right, make it up as you go along. You got my blessing to do that. And, of course, they did so. And the character of Rusty Regan is very hard to figure out who killed him. It's very much a secondary plot line to it. But I'll see if I can find a decent précis of the movie. It's very hard to get a synopsis that works. I mean, the one on IMDb says, Private Detective Philip Marlowe is hired by a rich family. Before the complex case is over, he sees murder, blackmail, and what might be love. Now, that's as vague as you could get and could be any one of 50 or 60 other films. Let's try this one. Summoned by the dying General Sternwood, Philip Marlowe is asked to deal with several problems that are troubling his family, including blackmail. Marlowe finds that each problem centers around the disappearance of Sternwood's favorite employee, who are left with the mobster's wife. Each of the problems becomes a cover for something else as Marlowe probes. So that's basically it. And the loveliest, there are a couple of lovely things about this film. A, Bogart is at his peak, and he has a lot of fun playing this role. He's in love with Lauren Bacall, of course. They've been together for a couple of years. His previous marriages were problematic and at times physically violent, not on his part, but on his wife's part. One of his wives was prone to throw things, and he wasn't always sober enough to duck. But having said that, Bogart's happy, and he's playing it up, and his tongue's slightly in his cheek in this one. And the dialogue by Firthman, William Faulkner, and Lee Brackett is spicy. That the Hays Code and the censorship people were all over this movie like ants on sugar. But these people were fine writers, and they thought we're going to find oblique ways to emphasize things and to indicate that there is sexuality and sexual interest among various of the characters. I'll just play a little bit from the movie that gives you a little bit of an idea. It's dialogue between Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart. We're using horse racing analogies to convey their mutual interest and to start negotiations on a relationship.
I'm late. I'm sorry.
How are you today?
Better than last night.
Well, I could agree on that.
Well, hello, Max.
Good afternoon, Mrs. Rutledge.
Got a table for us?
Certainly, madam. This way, please.
I'll have a scotch, miss.
Yes, sir.
A scotch and plain water.
Yes, sir.
Well, how'd you happen to pick out this place?
Maybe I wanted to hold your hand.
Oh, that can be arranged. What do you want to see me about?
Well, one thing. My father was very pleased when he saw the morning papers. So was I.
Yes, we were lucky. I managed to keep the Sternwoods out of it.
He hopes you didn't involve yourself too deeply.
Did you tell him it was no fault of yours?
No. He asked me to give you a check.
I don't need any money yet.
He considers the case closed.
Oh?
It is, isn't it?
Well, as far as Geiger's concerned, yes.
Then it's completely closed. I hope this is satisfactory.
500? Well, that's a lot more than I expected, but welcome just the same.
We're very grateful to you, Mr. Marlowe, and I'm very glad it's all over. Tell me, what do you usually do when you're not working?
Play the horses, fool around.
No women?
Well, I'm generally working on something most of the time.
Could that be stretched to include me?
Well, I like you. I told you that before.
I liked hearing you say it.
Hmm.
But you didn't do much about it.
Well, neither did you.
Well, speaking of horses, I like to play them myself. But I like to see them work out a little first. See if they're front runners or come from behind. Find out what their whole card is. What makes them run.
Find out mine?
I think so.
Go ahead.
I'd say you don't like to be rated. You like to get out in front. Open up a lead, take a little breather in the back stretch, and then come home free.
You don't like to be raided yourself.
I haven't met anyone yet that could do it. Any suggestions?
Well, I can't tell till I've seen you over a distance of ground. Got a touch of class, but I don't know how far you can go.
A lot depends on who's in the saddle. Go ahead, Marlo. I like the way you work. In case you don't know it, you're doing all right.
There's one thing I can't figure out.
What makes me run?
Uh-huh.
I'll give you a little hint. Sugar won't work. It's been tried.
What'd you try it on me for? Who told you to sugar me off this case? Was it Eddie Mars? All right. Don't answer me. But somebody put you up to it, and it wasn't your father. He didn't tell you to pay me off, did he?
No, he's not well. I used my own judgment.
Are you sure?
Of course I know it hasn't worked so well up till now.
What's Eddie Mars got to do with this case?
Nothing. He runs a gambling house. I play horses, I play the wheel.
Playing something else, too.
What makes
you
think...
Never mind talking. Let me do it. Did you know it was Eddie Mars' blonde wife, Sean Regan, was supposed to run off with?
Who doesn't?
Did you know he owned the house Geiger operated in, that he was mixed up in that racket, too?
No, I don't believe
it. Then why does it bother you so much? What's Eddie Mars got on you? Oh, come now, Angel. Stop shaking. I don't want to hurt you. I'm trying to help you. Well, you better run along. But you made a deal and you're going to stick to it, right or wrong. We'll take up the question of you and I when the race is over. The only trouble is we could have...
Pardon me.
Yes. The only trouble is we could have had a lot of fun if you weren't a detective.
We still can.
So long, Mom.
I deliberately let that clip run long for a specific reason, but that goes to show you the dialogue and the kind of wonderfulness of it that this movie has. Now, the reason I let the clip run long is, with Warner Brothers movies, there's always an extra layer to the good ones, and that is, particularly in nightclub scenes, the music playing in the background, sometimes commentary on the stuff in the foreground. Now, if you had listened to that clip very carefully, and you know your music, you'd know that the music playing in the background of that piano music, it started out with, "I think I'm going to change my plan," which has famously been sung in the movies by Fred Astaire. So we've got, "I think I'm going to change my plan," and right at the end, the piano's playing "You Go to My Head." So there's a kind of arc to their talk and their negotiations and the start of the relationship between Vivian Sternwood Rutledge and Philip Marlowe, which is commented on by the piano in the background. And I love that stuff. I love the fact that they bothered to do that. And I love the fact that if you know what you're listening to and you kind of go into it just that little bit deeper, you do get a meta commentary on the foreground scenes. That's just wonderful stuff, and I really appreciate it when it happens. Happens a little bit in Casablanca as well, if you listen closely. I'm going to have to check out a few more classic Warner Brothers films just to see where and when that occurs, because it's a lot of fun, and it's almost like steganography. Steganography is extra data hidden in a picture where if you... take the picture, and the extra bytes in the pixels can be used to convey a message. It's a bit like cinematic steganography, where the music tells you something else as well. It's kind of encrypted into the movie. So that is one of the things that I find that makes me go a bit squee when it comes to films. Those Easter eggs that aren't always made apparent, but are there if you just know what to look for. But the movie is a fine one, and a lot of the women in the movie are very forthright in their sexuality. You've got to remember that it was filmed during the war. There weren't a lot of available men around, and so people like Philip Marlowe, who were unattached and not unattractive to women, tended to do okay. There's a scene while Philip Marlowe is doing surveillance on Geiger's bookshop, which is a front for a pornography racket, even though that's only vaguely alluded to in the movie, but more explicitly alluded to in the book. And he takes cover in a bookshop across the road as it rains. And the bookshop salesperson, played by Dorothy Malone, is interested in Marlowe, and there's a slight implication, which I'm going to run with anyway, that when she closes up the bookshop, they dally, and they don't just drink bourbon out of paper cups, but they have a little liaison while he's waiting for Geiger to come out and for him to follow him and see where he's going. So there's that as well. And there's another scene where Marla gets into a cab, and of course during wartime there were a lot of women cab drivers in America, and a quite a cute little cab driver does make it apparent that she too is interested in Philip Marlowe, which I kind of really like a fair bit. I think it's flying in the face of conformity when they do that, and there's a kind of not necessarily a reality, because movies aren't always reality based, and particularly a genre film like this is very stylized, but it's based a little bit in a human reality that people do get together and have been known to dally with one another. That cab driver is played by an actress called Joy Barlow, who had a fairly long career in the 40s and early 50s. And she kind of makes a nice impression. She was also in To Have and Have Not, so she was an extra in that. Most of the roles she had, in fact, all of the roles I could see except for one, were uncredited. But she was a bit of fun in there, and it's one of those things where, it was a follow-that-cab kind of scene, which was spiced up and made more interesting by the flirting between Philip Marlowe and the unnamed cab driver. And I like that too, the fact that they put in a female cab driver, because usually the cliche was, an old grizzled guy with a stub of a cigar in his mouth and a cap on is the cab driver, but Hawks didn't go that way. Now, whether this was because Joy Barlow was someone's girlfriend or not, I don't know, but one way or the other, there are at least as many roles for women in this film as there are for men, and the women are living on their own terms, which I kind of like. And also makes it feel less dated than a lot of other films where the gender roles are much more cliched and traditional. And, this is one of the reasons why people still watch movies like this, the fact that there are little bits that make it easier to relate to the characters in the movie and to relate to the plot. Now, Marlowe is very much less of a bastard than Sam Spade, the character in Dashiell Hammett's novels, which Bogart, of course, played in The Maltese Falcon. I think that Sam Spade's much more of a psycho character. He's having an affair with his partner's wife. He's having an affair with his secretary. He's not a nice character, which, of course, Philip Marlowe essentially is. He's a tarnished knight in a corrupt world. And he's admirable for that, the fact that he's aware of the corruption and he will skirt around it. And he'll dip his finger in it now and then and use it to make sure that justice occurs. But he doesn't go bathing in it the way that a character like Sam Spade does. So it's kind of two sides to the same coin, and two very different detectives, even though superficially they can appear the same and have been played by the same actors. But, this one, of course, is in glorious black and white. And one of the things I like about the black and white cinematography of this, and there's a couple of scenes in the rain, and I don't know whether it's the lighting or just the way that most of it's based in a studio, so this isn't a location shooting at all, but when it's raining and they're driving around in cars, there's a sheen and a slight glow to the water bouncing off the roofs of cars and the roofs of letterboxes and other things like that that give it a weird, slightly otherworldly look, which I kind of enjoy the fact that occurs. Whereas these days with high definition video and things like that, that kind of effect is a lot harder to pull off, but there's something that they did at Warner Brothers that really does There's a kind of oily luminescence to the rain bouncing off the roofs of things, which I like the look of it, and it's something I associate with Warner Brothers movies more than anything else. Maybe the directors of photography they had had a way of angling the lights, or maybe there was something they put in the water to make it show up better on film. I don't know, but one way or the other, the water always looks good in the rain scenes in these kind of movies. And again, it's a classic film, and I think that Bogart's portrayal, the lovely thing about the Philip Marlowe character is, you've got Bogart, he played Philip Marlowe. Dick Powell played a very good Philip Marlowe in Murder, My Sweet. You've got Robert Mitchum playing it much, much later in the 1970s in a remake of The Big Sleep, which is not quite as good, but is a bit more explicit in the plot line than this version of The Big Sleep, where it's all a little bit cryptic because the censors wouldn't let you say or allude to certain things. Yeah, homosexuality is one of the themes in the book that is ignored in the movie. Pornography, illicit sex, and all sorts of other things. Drug use is a little bit in the book, but the way it's portrayed is that Carmen Stern would smash, but they don't say whether she smashed on drugs or smashed on alcohol, because the hypocrisy of the time was that alcohol is fine, even though it's just as dangerous as some drugs. Alcohol is fine, but you can't allude to drug use at all, which is a bit stupid because alcohol essentially is a drug. But anyway, the movie is a fine one. I don't like Max Steiner's score for it particularly at the start of the film. I think it's a little too heavy-handed for the movie, where a slightly less bombastic composer and conductor may have done a better job. But he was the house guy at Warner Brothers and had done a whole bunch of other things and had done a number of good soundtracks as well. But I think in this case, for this particular film, The Big Sleep, it's just a little heavy-handed at the start. But I like the ensemble. I like the rapport between Bogart and Bacall. I also like Martha Vickers a lot as Carmen Sturtwood, and she steals a number of scenes. And Raymond Chandler actually said that she stole a lot more of the film, but her role got cut to a certain extent because the studio and, of course, Bogart wanted to emphasize Lauren Bacall's character. Lauren Bacall was very early in her career and was still learning to be a good actor. And I think that Martha Vickers was a little too good for the role that she ended up playing. Now, if there's a little bit of a nod to this in another film that I've seen fairly recently, which is 1965's Harper. Now, at the start of The Big Sleep, General Sternwood's in a wheelchair in a hot house. He's not well. His legs are paralyzed. He's at the end of his life, and he's led a very disreputable life, which he admits to. And it is a quite a lovely scene too. There is a nice rapport between Philip Marlowe and General Sternwood, as played by Charles Waldron. And they don't both have a very good chop at the kind of hard-boiled dialogue there, which is really a lot of fun. Now, he died at the age of 71, so he wasn't particularly old, but in those days, people did tend to die earlier. He'd been in a number of movies going back as far as 1935, Madame X, Marie Antoinette's On Borrowed Time, The Devil and Miss Jones, not The Devil in Miss Jones, this is an entirely different kind of movie, but he was a jobbing actor born in 1874, but I kind of like the way he and Bogart play off each other in the start of the movie, and it does bring you into the film quite nicely. Now, the thing is that in Harper in 1966, having digressed here just a little bit, Lauren Bacall plays a very wealthy woman whose legs are paralyzed, who hires a private detective to investigate family members. So there's a little bit of Lauren Bacall playing the role that of the character who was her father in a previous movie 20 years later. And Lauren Bacall still looks good in the movie, and she's incredibly bitchy in Harper, which is not one of my favourite films. I keep going back to it because there are some aspects to it I like, but I think Paul Newman overacts ridiculously and should not have been paid for the role. Screenplay by William Goldman, too, which makes it a little bit interesting. But if Paul Newman hadn't have been such a mugging idiot in the film, it would have been a lot more respected as a detective movie. But anyway, that's about it for The Big Sleep. If you haven't seen it, you really should. If you haven't seen it in a while, you should revisit it, because that dialogue is beautiful. And that's one of the things that I kind of miss in so many modern films. The dialogue isn't up to scratch. We were actually talking about dialogue with Rob Jam when we were doing the Marvel Cinematic Universe, talking about the dialogue for people like Shane Black and Joss Whedon, mate. And there are still people like those two guys who are doing good dialogue in films. Of course, David Mamet and a few others. But they're the exception rather than the rule. There's a lot of really ordinary dialogue in movies these days. And going back and visiting a movie where the dialogue of necessity, just to get it onto the screen, had to be oblique and had to be complicated and had to be just that little bit smarter than the people who were watchdogging everything they did, really is a joy to behold. The only thing that's happened recently at all like that is Joss Whedon sneaking mewling Quim past the censors in The Avengers. So there is a long tradition of sneaking things past the prudish watchdogs of cinema. And I love the fact that movie makers constantly try to do that. They constantly try to push boundaries, and they constantly try to thwart the people who think that they know best for everybody else. And this movie is in a continuum of that. And I think that the forthrightness of the female characters in the movie is very attractive. And it's a good story apart from anything else. It doesn't matter who killed Rusty Regan in the movie. What matters is the journey you go on with these characters and the fact that everybody in the film seems to be having a good time with it. So I'm going to take another break now. And when I get back, we're going to talk about one of the biggest movies of all time and one that's worth revisiting. 1962's David Lean directed Lawrence of Arabia.
I guess I'll have to change my plan. I should have realized there'd be another man. I overlooked that point completely until the big affair began. Before I knew where I was at, I found myself up on the shelf, and that was that. I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air. My feet are back upon the ground. I've lost the one girl I found.
Head but you rise like a summer with a thousand Julys. You intoxicate my soul with your eyes. Though I'm certain that this heart of mine hasn't the ghost of a chance in this crazy romance. You go to my head. You go to my head.
That was Fred Astaire and Jack Buchanan with I Guess I'll Have to Change My Plan. I misspoke and said I think I'll have going to change my plan as the title of that track, followed by Billie Holiday with You Go to My Head, just to show you what those two sound like. So we're on to Lawrence of Arabia. Now, I've got a confession to make. Watching Lawrence of Arabia this week is the first time I've ever watched it. Yes, I know it's one of those very, very big movies, but I was a little too young when it came out to see it on the big screen. Nobody's going to take a five-year-old to a four-hour movie. And seeing it on old-fashioned free-to-air TV, where they probably showed a pan-and-scan version of it, wasn't really going to be a good film experience. I actually had a chat with my mate Jamie, who's a bit of a movie buff, yesterday at a garden party we went to at his place. I said I was going to do Lawrence of Arabia for the podcast, and he said, the weird thing about Lawrence of Arabia is the bigger the screen you see it on, the better the film it is. You've got to see it on at least a large TV in Blu-ray to fully appreciate the movie. But if you can see it in the great big Panavision 70mm print at an Encore cinema, then you're going to get the full-blown effect of the film. And, you know, I can definitely see his point with that. It's a movie where the landscapes are one of the major characters. Now, the film came out in 1962. It took about 18 months to 2 years to film, given the location shooting and the perfectionism of the director, David Lean. It stars, of course, Peter O'Toole, Alec Guinness, Anthony Quinn, Jack Hawkins, Jose Ferrer, Anthony Quayle, Claude Rains, Arthur Kennedy, and Omar Sharif. And Peter O'Toole gets an introducing Peter O'Toole as Lawrence credit on the film. Now, in case you don't know about T.E. Lawrence, still quite a controversial character to this day. He wrote a book called Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and there are some vague allusions to a few things and to love between men, whether it's a platonic love or not, who knows. But the arguments are he may have been a sexual masochist and he may have been homosexual at a time where that was all but unthinkable, particularly for a gentleman and a soldier. And there's no doubt that he was captured by the Ottoman Turks during World War I, tortured and possibly raped. So there are all sorts of things. And that gets alluded to slightly obliquely in this movie as well. Lauren, basically, I'll see if I can get a decent précis of the film. Most people know what it is, but I'll see what I can find here just for the people who came in late. IMDb says, a flamboyant and controversial British military officer and his conflicted loyalties during his World War I service in the Middle East, which doesn't actually make sense as a sentence. And I fucking hate it when IMDb does that. Let's see. We've got a better one here. I'll go take a look at the plot synopsis we've got here by someone called Alfie Hitchie on IMDb. an inordinately complex man who has been labelled everything from hero to charlatan to sadist, Thomas Edward Lawrence blazed his way to glory in the Arabian desert, then sought anonymity as a common soldier under an assumed name. The story opens with the death of Lawrence in a motorcycle accident in Dorset at the age of 46, then flashes back to recount his adventures as a young intelligence officer in Cairo in 1916. He was given leave to investigate the progress of the Arab revolt against the Turks in World War I. In the desert, he organizes a guerrilla army and for 2 years leads the Arabs in harassing the Turks with desert raids, train wrecks, and camel attacks. Eventually, he leads his army northward and helps the British general destroy the power of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East. That one works better. I will go with that one. I will pay that one. So, David Lean, interesting director, didn't start out making these great, big, enormous, complicated and lengthy blockbusters. Well, up, he's got 19 credits on IMDb, and a lot of them are a much smaller scale than the things that most people know him for. He did In Which We Serve in 1942, which is a good, solid war movie. This Happy Breath, Blithe Spirit, the one with Rex Harrison and Margaret Rutherford. Brief Encounter, which is one of the great weepies of all times. Great Expectations, Oliver Twist, Breaking the Sound Barrier, Hobson's Choice. And then he starts kicking it into high gear with Bridge on the River Kwai, Lawrence of Arabia. He did some scenes in The Greatest Story Ever Told, Dr. Zhivago, Ryan's Daughter, and A Passage to India was his last film in 1984, and he died in 1991. So there's a pretty good track record there of David Lean films, but he was obsessively meticulous in everything he did in the film, and Lawrence of Arabia, I think, is really the high point of this. They filmed all across the Middle East in various deserts, and it was an arduous shoot for everybody involved, particularly Peter O'Toole. Peter O'Toole was first spotted by David Lean in a very much different film, which I watched a little while ago, a film called The Day They Robbed the Bank of England, in which he was very good. He'd done a few other things previously. He did a version of Kidnapped in 1960, a TV movie called The Long, the Short, and the Tall, and a TV series playing a soldier in a TV series of The Scarlet Pimpernel. He's an Irish actor, O'Toole, and started out doing rep and doing theatre. Served as a radio man for the Royal Navy for 2 years in the early 1950s. He was born in Connemara in 1932. Married to Sian Phillips. He's in one movie that I know with Sian Phillips, which was Murphy's War, which is another interesting film of his. One of the notorious hellraisers and drinkers of cinema history, along with people like Richard Burton and Ollie Reed. He was just one of those hellraisers who incredibly fond of the booze. And the fact that he's lived this long is a testament to either the kind of alcohol he drinks pickling his intestines, or else just, you know, an unnatural ability to consume things and live through it. In fact, he's got two movies set for 2014, so he's had a very long and distinguished career. And in this, he's incredibly charismatic. It's hard to do charismatic as well as doing fearful and shell-shocked and distressed, but he does do that very successfully. And he's supported by some of the best of the best of the time. You've got Alec Guinness, of course, who'd had a long career way before this film was made, playing Prince Faisal. And he's, yeah, okay, well, I'll step back a step there and say one of the things about this film, of course, because it was a 1962 British film, is there are going to be a certain number of character actors playing in brownface. And Alec Guinness playing the ultimate Arab, in a sense, as Prince Faisal, is somebody doing brownface makeup and playing someone other than their own race. Same thing can be said for Anthony Quinn. Anthony Quinn plays a real-life character who's a very interesting person called Orde Ibu Tayi. And if you go to his IMDb page, Orde Ibu Tayi, very interesting-looking guy. There's a hand-tinted colour photo of him, and he looks like somebody you don't fuck around with. But he was actually a sortie, and kind of on the border of Saudi Arabia and Jordan, played by a half Irish, half Mexican actor, Anthony Quinn. But I think Anthony Quinn does do a very good job of it. And of course, he gets one of the great iconic lines of all cinema history.
23 great wounds, all got in battle. 75 men have I killed with my own hands in battle. I scatter, I burn my enemies' tents. I take away their flocks and herds. The Turks pay me a golden treasure, yet I am poor, because I am a river to my people.
And the writing of this film's got to be commended as well. I just love that, I am a river to my people, yay! But the writing by Robert Bolt is really good. It was based on some of Lawrence's own writings. But, yeah, and Anthony Quinn with the hawkish fake nose and playing it as loud as he can. In a movie like this, playing it slightly bigger than life is recommended because the landscape's going to steal the scene away from you if you don't do that. And, of course, Lean filmed the desert scenes as they had not been filmed previously. Immense sand dunes with little flurries of dust blowing across them as two tiny figures and two camels travel across the sand dunes. And the great salt flat plains that one of the raids crosses, which is basically going to take about 18 hours to cross if you live through it because the temperatures are so high and nobody had ever crossed. Lawrence convinces the raiding party to cross it. And with this enormous widescreen and the flat horizon of the salt pans bisecting the screen horizontally, perfectly, almost geometrically perfectly, with a few tiny figures crossing everybody in the film, almost every scene in this film, action goes from left to right because Lean wanted to make the whole movie a journey. So everything goes left to right, from Lawrence on the motorcycle at the start to the end. There's only a couple of tiny pieces where anybody moves anything but left to right on the screen. And that gives you a sense of that journey in an immense way. It's of course, there's an intermission at the center of the film as well, but I don't think it's slow-paced at all. I think the 4 hours almost that it takes for this film are filled up. And having that time and not hurrying the scenes and having long cuts and letting the story unfold the way that Lean does really works. Now, there are other films, we meant 70mm widescreen films, where you do get boring moments. The one that comes to mind is 2001, where Dave Bowman is retrieving the body of Gary Lockwood after the Howl the Robot goes mad. And it's painstakingly slow, for no good purpose apart from the fact that Kubrick wanted to prove that space travel was really boring because he was going against the 1960s trend where space travel was exciting and imminent and immediate thing. I reached for the fast-forward button in the cinema while watching 2001 because it was so slow and boring. But Lawrence of Arabia doesn't have that. The sense of the space and the sense of the hostility of the landscape is really, really powerful in this film. And that's what pulls us through. Kubrick in 2001 doesn't give us any sense of the hostility of space as an environment. He's too focused on other things. But in this one, in Lawrence of Arabia, the heat is there. The cinematography is fantastic. In fact, they specially built a lens for one scene where Lawrence and his guide at the start of the film are traveling across the desert and stop at a waterhole, which is basically a hole in the middle of the desert, nothing else further than that. And the guide, whose name was Tafas, played by Zia Mohedan, I stopped there, and they see something in a mirage in the distance, and slowly that thing they see in the distance materializes as a man on a camel, and it's filmed in an extreme long shot so that the figure, who turns out to be Omar Sharif, kind of manifests out of this mirage. Now, they had a special lens that they had to have built to be able to do that scene exactly the way that David Lean wanted it to be. Freddie Young, the DP, got a lens made specially by Panavision, a 482mm lens. It's never been used since. It's still called the David Lean lens. And it was created specifically for the shot, which shows that even when they were out in the desert, they were really focused on making this work. It's an incredible achievement as a film. And it does take you on a journey more than so many other films. And, of course, journey is a word that's become a cliche and that every motivational arsehole in an office talks about. But in this film, there is a real sense of Lawrence's journey and the price he pays to do what he does. And the skepticism and disrespect that he received from a lot of the military hierarchy while doing so. And, of course, these military people are played, in some cases, they were real-life characters. For instance, General Allenby, played by Jack Hawkins, was a real character as well. And a number of them were. Orda Abu Tayyi, Anthony Quinn's character, Prince Faisal, Alec Guinness's character, Lawrence, of course, and a few others. Now, Mr. Dryden, played by Claude Rains, is obviously an intelligence officer, and he's quite one of the later roles in Claude Rains' career, but I think he does a nice job of it as well. And at the start, Donald Wolfert overacting as General Murray. Donald Wolfert, well-known stage actor at the time, but I think he's a little too portly and a little too over the top for that particular role, but he did it as well. He actually did, I think he did a Hammer film. I'm just trying to look through his IMDb. I'm sure I've seen Donald Wolfert doing a film for Hammer Films at one stage. I was slightly wrong. It's not actually a Hammer film, but it is very much in the Hammer style. It's a vampire movie from 1958 called Blood of the Vampire. He was in that. And again, I don't think he was the best possible cinema actor. I think as a stage actor, he was obviously considered much, much more of a fine actor, but I think he never quite attuned himself to cinema the way a lot of other actors did. But nonetheless, he's in there as well. You've also got the Jose Ferrer coming in and doing a short bit of work as the Turkish Bey, the guy who interrogates Lawrence when he and the other prisoners are captured. And he does a very good job. I always liked Jose Ferrer as an actor ever since I first saw him in Serenade of Bergerac way back when I was a kid and I skipped school so I could stay home and watch it on the midday movie to watch Serenade of Bergerac. He does really good, and he does a very subtle way of portraying the sexuality of the Turkish Bey, who does torture Lawrence in the movie, but there's implications of other things as well. I'm just looking at the trivia on IMDb, and it says, in his autobiography and in the letter to George Bernard Shaw's wife, there are indications that Lawrence was forced to perform homosexual acts for the Turkish governor of Dera, something which the film skims over. However, both friends and enemies of the governor alike dismissed Lawrence's claims as fantasies and insist that the governor was not homosexual. Well, you could say they would, but it's a bit odd that that would persist in spite of all the protestations to the contrary. Let's have a look here. Arthur Kennedy plays an American journalist who kind of creates the legend of Lawrence to a certain extent. Edmund O'Brien was originally going to play Jackson Bentley, the photojournalist, but he had a heart attack while on location after filming a few scenes. Kirk Douglas was considered for the part, but Douglas wanted a big salary in second billing after Peter O'Toole, so that got rejected. And they went, of course, with Arthur Kennedy, who does a good job too. The character isn't someone who needs an over-the-top kind of actor like Kirk Douglas or even Edmund O'Brien, who very frequently was known to overact where it was appropriate. But Yeah, I think Arthur Kennedy does a good job of it as well. Albert Finney was going to be Lawrence. There were a few people. They wanted to get Marlon Brando at the start to play Lawrence, but he was heading towards working on Mutiny on the Bounty, one of the great failure movies of that particular time. So Brando couldn't do it. And Albert Finney, there's actually some shots around of Albert Finney in Arab costume as Lawrence. If you look around, do a little bit of a Google search, you can find them as well. But, yeah, this film, it kind of sweeps over you a bit like, apparently David Lean watched John Ford's The Searchers time after time for inspiration for this film. And I can see it being very much in that same, not a genre necessarily, but in the same mood, that kind of landscape as character and people traveling through it on obsessive quests. I think that there's an argument that these two films do fit together really well. But I think that this film, more than any other, is the kind of pinnacle of David Lean's epic movies. And having seen it for the first time, I keep thinking back on various scenes. I keep thinking about Peter O'Toole and the way he plays the arc from the flippant intelligence officer kind of wasting his time colouring in maps in Cairo, to the character we see at the start of the film, at the end of his life, who you can tell is a danger freak because he's riding his motorbike very fast down a country lane and loves the danger and the thrill of it and has become addicted to danger and thrills, even though another part of him hates them. There's that kind of duality and that obsession that the character has with danger and with pushing himself and with fortifying the flesh, and that kind of combination of bravery and masochism that we suspect Lawrence himself had. Now, you're not going to know for sure, unless you get a time machine, you're not going to know the truth of this character, and that ambiguity kind of works in favor of the legend to a certain extent. But the way it's portrayed in the movie, Lawrence is not a nice person. He is inspirational. He does help the war effort in significant ways, including a very large raid on a Turkish enclave on the coast. But this film, it does take you to a place. It takes you to a time and a place. It takes you through a story. It takes you through the desert, and it gives you, I mean, I've traveled through deserts on roads, and it gives you the sense of that kind of endless land untouched pretty much by human beings. And just even driving through that kind of landscape, not necessarily being out off the beaten track, but even driving through that landscape or that type of a landscape, it's something that stays with you. It's something that is non-trivial. And it's, in this movie, I'm glad I got it on Blu-ray. I mean, I don't mind getting movies on the cheap. I mean, I'm a cheapskate when it comes to things. If I see things cheap on Blu-ray that I will watch, I'll get them. But the fact that I paid $10 for a two-disc set of Lawrence of Arabia on Blu-ray, beautifully restored, a movie that won 7 Academy Awards, a movie that's on a lot of people's lists of the best film of all time, feels a bit like I ripped somebody off. I don't know who, but it feels like I've ripped somebody off somewhere. And that it should be of more value, if you know what I mean. If you see Lawrence of Arabia, make sure you've got a decent TV if you're going to watch it on TV. If you get a chance to see it in the cinema, if I get a chance to see it in the cinema, I'm going to take it. But if you get a chance to see it in the cinema, definitely do so. You are going to be in for a four-hour session, but that being what it is, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But it is a profound movie, and I think it cost $15 million to make at the time and ended up making about $70 or $80 million. So it really did make its money back. But the film is one of the great epic adventures films of all time. It's not necessarily right up there with the best films of all time. Vertigo seems to get on the list, the one I did last week or last fortnight. But I recommend you see it, and I recommend you see it on as big a screen as you can, as good a quality print or disc as you can, because it's worth it. Put the time aside. I put the whole afternoon aside to watch this, and Yeah, it's I do like it, and I did enjoy it a hell of a lot. So that's about it for Lawrence of Arabia. I'm going to take a break now, and then we do have some feedback for you.
The English have a great hunger for desolate places. They hunger for Arabia. I think you are another of these desert-loving English.
I've been seconded to the Arab Bureau.
Of course I'm the man for the job. What is the job, by the way?
Have you no fear, English?
My fear is my concern.
We need a miracle.
They hope to gain their freedom. I'm going to give it to them.
A man who gives victory in battle is prized beyond every other.
It's going to be fun.
Native.
They think he's a kind of prophet.
They do, or he does.
It's one more failure, and you will find yourself alone.
Who are you to know what can be done? Nothing is written.
You're the most extraordinary man I ever met.
You are using up your nine lives very quickly.
For some men, nothing is written unless they write it.
Time to be great again, my lord.
Okay, on with the feedback. The first one I got on the Paleo Cinema website, which I don't get that often, but thank you for Dave Brandt. He left a comment on the Paleo Cinema website. Hey, Terry, must be one of the boring people who agree with the conventional wisdom about Vertigo. I think it's one of the greatest masterpieces of the 20th century cinema, along with another character study of some newspaper man, obviously a reference to Citizen Kane. But that was just black and white. Vertigo is in colour and widescreen, so it must be better. Yeah, I think the casting was superb, especially the leads. I've heard the story that Jamie Stewart was too old, but that was in the context of explaining why it wasn't the box office hit that it deserved to be. I suppose that the box office wasn't great, since it is a disturbing film. It wasn't a conventional drama that the public was conditioned to expect. That's all. Casting an age-appropriate leading man would have been better for the box office, but it undercuts the impact of the film. Long-term impact, 50-plus years later, I can explain. Hitch was deliberately casting against the James Stewart persona. By the time he made this, Jimmy Stewart had 25 years building up his persona as an all-American hero. He played Lindbergh, Glenn Miller, and he played all those westerns and all those Capra flicks. But now he's playing a deeply troubled, obsessed, twisted guy. On the surface, he's a fine, upstanding middle American. In terms of 1950s TV, it would be like casting one of the all-American dads as Scotty, the character in Vertigo. The dad from Mozzie and Harriet lived to be the father knows best. But this time, father doesn't know best. But that's the point. That's the movie. What James Stewart could do is bring his persona with him, but Hitch twisted it to show the very dark side of 1950s Americana. Another point is that it strengthens how committed Scotty was to his obsession. The huge difference in ages is invisible to him, but very visible to us. We can see that it can't be a healthy relationship, but he can't even begin to think about whether he is a desirable mate for a young woman. It can't even occur to him. Scotty is deeply sexist, i.e. the all-American boy is deeply sexist. For example, in the pivotal scene in the hotel room where Scotty finally succeeds in making her put on the costume, he comes right out and says that her feelings couldn't possibly matter. In his world, young women exist to act out men's fantasies. They're playmates. Did Sal watch Vertigo with you? Just wondering. No, she didn't. One more thing. Nowadays, one can't watch this without thinking about Hitch's determination to remake Tippi Hedren into his mythical Hitchcock blonde fantasy figure. It's amazing that he actually made a movie about that sort of obsession a few years earlier. Yeah, thanks, Dave. I understand your points there, and I don't entirely agree with them. And in fact, I left a message on the Paleo Cinema website as well. And this is what I said. I see your point, Dave, but Stewart had already got rid of the all American boy persona after his World War II service in movies like Bend in the River, Rope and Rear Window. Perhaps Hitchcock cast him to work with someone whom he already knew. I still think it's dodgy casting, but we can cordially disagree. And that's what I think it is. I think that there were a number of other actors that could have worked really well, but Hitchcock wanted familiar so he could focus on the technical aspects. Actors were less important than the way he told the story to Hitchcock. But, I mean, we can disagree, Dave, and that's perfectly fine that we do, because that's what it's all about. Let's have a look. And I actually have some MP3 feedback from Richard Palmer. Just be a sec, and I will play that.
Hello, Terry. Rich Palmer of the Rotcast podcast. I haven't spoken with you in a while, but I've been listening this whole time, and I really enjoyed your podcast on Vertigo and Uptight. I liked hearing about the origins of the Vertigo story in particular. I'm quite a fan of Hitchcock. Isn't it remarkable how he used rear screen projection? I would guess that the craftsman in him would like the control that it gives to shoot actors perfectly lit in front of a perfectly shot backdrop. But the composite makes the film look unreal, which is perfect. He used it all the time, so it's like part of his style. In any other director's movie, it would just look like crap. About the mismatch in ages of Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak, I think it's all right in Vertigo, mainly because Stewart is a patsy, and it wouldn't matter if a young thing is used as bait. She's meant to distract him. The unbelievable part would be if they never used a line like, "But I'm too old for you," which I don't think they do. I haven't seen it in a while. I'm positive they don't say that line in Bell, Book, and Candle. I love that movie, but the age difference there is quite wrong. Stewart is under a spell, but there isn't any reason for a young Novak to put the moves on a geezer. He's engaged to another young woman, Novak's schoolmate, which means the women are roughly the same age. Stewart obviously only dates women half his age. His secretary is also in the same age range. Story logic might say that his place as a publishing power player is attractive, but I can't suspend my disbelief. The movie is a total male fantasy, but you know what? I just go with it because I'm an old man.
Oh, I agree with about Bell, Book, and Candle. I think I have done it previously in a podcast, Bell, Book, and Candle. But I like the film, but yeah, the age discrepancy there is even more obvious than it is in Vertigo. But I still think in Vertigo, it doesn't quite gel for me. But yeah, that's it. There's a diversity of opinion. I still like the film a lot, and that's really my one caveat for it is that that the age thing is wrong. But Rich also sent me an email subsequent to that very nice voicemail, saying, who could replace Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo? How about Rod Taylor, who'll be 28 to Novak's 25 years of age? He appeared in a later Hitchcock film, but could we buy him as obsessed or frightened of high places? Yeah, I think that, I do think Rod Taylor had more range than really he was given credit for. If you look at something like Dark of the Sun or Young Cassidy, or a couple of the other minor films he did, I definitely think he could play it. There are a few other people that could. I mean, Sean Connery, had the movie been made 10 years later, Sean Connery might have made it work, perhaps. You can always play those games. Who would be good in this role? And they're a lot of fun to speculate about. I even think someone like Mitchum could have made a fair go at it. I don't know whether I mentioned that last week, but I think that Mitchum has a combination of toughness and vulnerability at his best that occasionally really did head in that kind of a direction. But yeah, Vertigo is quite an interesting film. I recorded the last podcast too, by the way, speaking of the other film that I did in that one, Uptight, I've managed to locate a Blu-ray copy of it, I think, or a DVD, one of the two. Anyway, I'm getting it a good copy of it. And I'm going to enjoy re-watching that in that context on the widescreen, because the one I had was a in Academy ratio, but I really do want to see Uptight in the widescreen. So with part of my Newton Mass money, I invested in that movie. I also got some feedback from John Johnson. I'm just going to bring that up and read it out. John says, "Great show, many thanks. So glad to hear someone else felt the same way about Jimmy's casting. I never realized I felt this way about the film until the last rewatch, like you picking up the Essentials box set. Vertigo is such a revered film by filmmakers whose opinions really matter to me, and with the additional attention it's getting because of the sight and sound list, it really bothered me that my estimation seemed to be going down while rising with the Vox Populi. The first thing that always bothered me is the scene where Jimmy is demonstrating to Midge in the kitchen stool how he's going to beat his condition and then folding like an origami flower into Midge's overly masculine arms. This has to be one of the wimpiest things I've seen a golden era star do. Then there is the odd bit of innuendo on Mr. Hitchcock's part in the costuming of Barbara Bel Geddes, who is deliberately butched up, looking like she is on her way to an LGPA tournament. Is Hitch suggesting that the strong think-for-themselves girls are butch, and that the needier, more compliant type of women exemplify femininity? Just asking the questions here. Another thing that's bothered me is the unlikely third act. How probable is it that Judy, with a visit to the gas chamber hanging over her head, would choose to hide in plain sight waiting for Scotty to recognize her on the streets? To what end? Is she so obsessed with him that she's pretending not to know him? None of it makes a lick of sense. If Hitch had worried about the plot holes in the script and less about what brassiere the woman would be wearing, the film might have had a better critical and box office reception. And last but certainly not least, the rather obvious age difference. It sort of made my skin crawl. While we want to blame Hitch here, this is really a problem that spills over into many of Stewart's later films. How disgusting is it to see him pouring a young Carol Baker in How the West Was Won? Even in the more or less independent films he made with Anthony Mann, you see that sort of thing repeated. This was clearly a sign of the times, but it is a cup from which Jimmy drank with abandon. Still, Vertigo is probably my favourite Hitchcock film, with its visuals married to Bernadette Herrmann's brilliant score. It is fun to watch Stewart playing out the obsessive Scotty. Much like the half-baked psychology at the end of Psycho, Stewart's performance, as well as the film itself, seems informed more by Reader's Digest than any real understanding of psychology. Scotty's obsession with Kim Novak makes sense to me, though. She had a sexual quality that is lacking in Grace Kelly or Tippi Hedren, whose vaginas might be forged to Tiffany Glass. Novak is a tigress. Oh, well, before I slip into obsession, I simply repeat my thanks for your good work. And, yeah, I'm not too sure about Tiffany Glass vaginas, because that just is an image that I don't really want to run with. But I do understand, yeah. The thing is that that's a common thing in so many films with big stars at the time. And, again, it happens in modern cinema, but it's been called out a lot more now. That age inappropriateness, which really is problematic. Now, for me, I mean, I'm in my mid-50s. The female actors who I find attractive tend to be 40 plus. People like, let's see, who is it? Julianne Moore, I like a lot. Of course, Helen Mirren. Everybody loves Helen Mirren. And a number of others I can name, but I'm not going to go that deeply into my own little obsessions. But kind of the age of appropriateness, there's a certain confidence that women of a certain age have that younger women don't tend to, in my knowledge. And it's a lot of fun. Just kind of speculating, of course, on who you would recast certain movies with age appropriately, which actor you would match with which actress. I know they're all called actors now, but I'm doing this to kind of balance out the genders. And how that would have changed the way the film was. There are so many female actors, people like Betty Davis, who when they turned a certain age started only playing harpies and bitches. And I don't think that's particular, even though you can make the argument that she always did play those kind of roles. There are a number of really fine actors who just didn't get a chance when there were opportunities had people been more enlightened about these things. And of course, people are a product of their culture and a product of the world they live in and a product of their times. But yeah, I mean, it's something we can re-examine and try to look at with the clarity of hindsight and just see what works. And Vertigo is one of those films that will open up those kind of questions. Bell, Book and Candle, I like, except for Jimmy Stewart being a bit too old. I mean, I really do like that movie. I think it's got a good ensemble with Elsa Lanchester and Jack Lemmon, of course, and everybody else in the film, and Ernie Kovacs as well. But I've talked about that in a previous podcast. I won't go too deeply into that. But, yeah, it's good to look at these ones through the lens of the 21st century and to see why they worked at the time. And the thing is, Vertigo didn't work at the time. It's only later on that it really became the film we know it to be in people's eyes. But we can still appreciate the film, appreciate the professionalism, appreciate the fact that Hitchcock did use that rear projection. He used it really well in Vertigo. I think that it gave the San Francisco scene a dreamy quality about them. But it didn't work again later on when he did those nighttime car scenes in North by Northwest, when Roger Thorndike has alcohol poured in him and stuck in a car trying to drive down a mountain road. I don't think it works well in that. And to a certain extent, that takes me out of that film just for that one moment, even though I do like North by Northwest a lot. Vertigo, the twisted sexuality of it, the obsession, the age inappropriateness, the darkness of it, and the oblivion to the feelings of the other person that the character of Scotty does have makes it really interesting. And I think that's one of the reasons why it is appreciated more, is those flaws and the fact that from our more sophisticated viewpoint, we are more aware of how twisted it is than perhaps people were at the time it came out. So that's about it for the feedback and about it for the podcast. I've gone nearly an hour and a half on this one. And the Mouse and Drive-In one I did with Rob Jen is going to go even longer. But anyway, everybody enjoy the holiday season, whether you are Christian, Jew, atheist, Muslim, whatever you are, enjoy the end of the year. New Year's bring new opportunities, and 2014 will bring those. We just need to hang in there and look for the main chance. And I hope everybody stays warm, has a roof over their head, and stays sheltered. And we will all watch good films again in 2014. So you guys take care. Hang on, give me a moment. I'm going to take a look at my calendar. What is it? I should get a podcast in before the end of the year. What am I thinking? I'll have another Paleo Cinema out around the 29th. So I will see people again before 2014. There's no use waxing lyrical about it until then. But anyway, everybody take care, and I'll be back on the 29th of December with another podcast. So take care and stay warm in the Northern Hemisphere. And down here, everybody hydrate and keep out of the sun too much, okay? Bye.